Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Melissa Goodwin, and this is usually where I would tell y'all all to go ahead and be seated, but I think that... But I think that we're going to have to figure this out as we go. This is the Texas Third Court of Appeals first Zoom argument. So as you can see, we're already going to have some technical glitches with. We appreciate your patience and for working with us and keeping our docket going. As to some preliminary matters for the parties, I understand that the clerk of the court has apprised you of our electronic records issues and on our record availability. On behalf of all of the members of this panel, I want to say that we appreciate your patience and with helping us work through it on this evolving situation. I also understand that much like counsel table in the actual courtroom, that we may have other lawyers participating or observing in Zoom, just so that we skip that 30-second YouTube lag. If that's the case, that's great, but let's only have the lead attorney address the court, again, because of that ability to interrupt and override each other. On behalf of the judges, I'm taking it upon myself to say that we're going to do our best to not interrupt y'all as well, because when we do so, then we can't hear what you're saying. But for those of you who've practiced frequently before the Texas Third Court of Appeals, you know that we like to ask our questions, and so us holding back, well, that's a tall order for us. As always, the audio file of today's proceedings will be available on the court's website as soon as the clerk of the court is able to post that. And finally, on time, Mr. Boyd, I understand that you've chosen to divide your time today as 10 minutes and 10 minutes. Is that accurate?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And Ms. Miller, you are dividing your time as 15 and 5?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, then you should both be able to see your time on the little timekeeper thing that is usually harder to see, and we give instructions on green, yellow, and red. But as y'all can see, the timekeeper is on the Zoom tiles. If you get to the end of your direct time, you can continue, but be aware that you'll be eating into your rebuttal time. And when you get to the end of all of your time, please feel free to continue to answer the last question that was posed to you. But please don't continue beyond that without leave of court. And I think with that, we're ready to go ahead and get started. So I'm going to call cause number 0319401CV, Laura Hampton, appellant and cross appellee versus Equity Trust Company, appellee and cross appellant. And I'll be taking announcements, and then we'll get started. For Laura Hampton.
Your Honor, Derek Boyd for Laura Hampton.
And for Equity Trust Company.
Rhonda Miller of Jackson Walker for Equity Trust Company.
And with that, Mr. Boyd, I think we're ready for you to proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. And I know Ms. Miller and I both want to echo thanks to the court for accommodating this new world and allowing this case to go forward. Laura Hampton comes to this court asking it to restore the jury's verdict. She does so after 7 years of litigation, after Judge Triana found her claims and evidence worthy of a trial, and after a 6-day trial on the merits. That's all she wants, is just what the jury awarded. She was defrauded by a combination of Robert Langeth and Equity Trust. You don't have to take her word for it. That's exactly what the jury found. At trial, the jury found for Hampton on two claims against Equity Trust. Question 2, which was aiding and abetting under the Texas Securities Act, and question 7, which was aiding and abetting common law fraud. The trial court took away the TSA recovery as to Equity Trust and substantially reduced the aiding and abetting common law fraud recovery. Hampton appealed, raising two issues, asking the court to restore the verdict, and those are the two issues I would like to discuss in my opening session here this morning. Issue 1 concerns the aiding and abetting fraud claim. The jury answered yes to question 7, which makes Equity Trust jointly and severally liable for Robert Langeth's fraud. The trial court erred when it refused to hold Equity Trust jointly and severally liable. Now, Equity Trust has tried to paint this as us taking the position that Chapter 33 doesn't apply to this case. That's not our position. We agree Chapter 33 applies. This is a tort case. The trial court applied Chapter 33 by submitting Laura Hampton for her proportionate responsibility based on Equity Trust defense, trying to make her more than 50% responsible. The trial court also submitted Langeth and Equity Trust because Equity Trust had a contribution claim, both a common law right that it pled, and it has a contribution claim under the Texas Securities Act by statute. What Chapter 33 did not do was implicitly overrule centuries-old law of derivative and vicarious liability. That's what Judge Shulock did, and that's the error that we are complaining about on issue number one. Texas courts have harmonized, since Chapter 33 came out, Texas courts have harmonized its language with those longstanding principles of derivative liability. We cite the court to the negligent entrustment case, for example, out of Dallas, the Roselle case. There's a couple of knowing participation and aiding and abetting breach of fiduciary duty cases we cite from other courts of appeal, and the civil conspiracy case out of Dallas. In all of those cases, the courts held that the primary actor's conduct is imputed to the derivative liability party, the conspirator or the aider and abettor. What Equity Trust argues is that the Duenes case changed that. Now, Duenes is different. Duenes involved a dram shop case in which you had the independent negligence of the drunk driver and the independent negligence of the bar that oversold the driver. Both of those were properly submitted under Chapter 33. And in fact, Duenes made that distinction. And again, you don't have to take our word for it. This very court has made that distinction in Duenes. If you go to the Conkle versus Cherry case, a 2009 case decided by this court, it was a negligent entrustment case, but the court ruled that the entruster was not submitted in Chapter 33, did not operate to allocate liability between the driver and the entruster. What this court stated in that case is that, to use its words, the preferred approach is to submit the primary actor and hold the derivative party liable for that percentage.
That Mr. Boyd, can I interrupt you real quick?
Yes, Your Honor.
Has the Supreme Court ever recognized a cause of action under 876B of the restatement for aiding and abetting?
To short answer, no, Your Honor. They have not addressed that question one way or the other. 876 came up in the Jewell case originally, which is the concert of action theory. Interesting, aiding and abetting has come up in that context. It's also come up in the context of fraud in two cases that went to the Supreme Court. The Ernst & Young case, accounting malpractice case, and the Grant Thornton case. In both of those cases, the court made the point, we have not yet addressed the issue of whether aiding and abetting common law fraud is a cause of action.
So Mr. Boyd, then if the Supreme Court has not addressed that whether or not address that as a viable claim, then what authority empowers us as an intermediary court to recognize that ground of recovery in that type of situation?
Well, I think it's the same body of law that both Judge Triana relied upon in denying summary judgment and Judge Shulock relied upon in denying directed verdict. There is a body of case law in the courts of appeal that has specifically affirmed and awarded damages for aiding and abetting fraud. The lead case we cite is the Chris case. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, and Mr. Boyd, are you familiar with the Anderson versus Archer case, 490 Southwest 3rd, 175?
I have.
In Anderson, 490.
Okay.
Southwest 3rd, 175. In Anderson, this court reversed and rendered a take nothing judgment on the question of whether or not there was a cause of action for tortious interference with the right of inheritance, and whether that was a viable cause of action. And in that case, this court specifically said, absent legislative or Supreme Court recognition of the existence of a cause of action, we as an intermediate appellate court will not be the first to do so. And that principle was even affirmed by the Supreme Court when they took up that very case. Are you familiar with that case? And what is its import on this decision here today?
I'm not familiar with that exact case, Your Honor, but I'm familiar with cases like that where that position has been taken. What our position is we go back to the longstanding body of Texas law, which says that those that participate in a fraud are jointly and severally liable. That's been the law for Texas for years, and that's what the Crisp case out of the Amarillo Court of Appeals relied upon to enforce the aiding and abetting cause of action that it did. I will agree with the court that the Supreme Court, when this has come squarely before it, has said we have not addressed this issue one way or the other. And so we would stand on the same body of law that the trial courts below stood on when they submitted this case. You know, maybe this case is the case that the Supreme Court makes that decision one way or the other, because I think it is squarely presented in this case. But I know, for example, the cases that Equity Trust relies upon, the Solis case and the Amwins case, those don't arise in the context of fraud. And I think the distinction I would make with the Arthur Anderson is there isn't that longstanding body of law in Texas courts that those that participate in a fraud are jointly and severally liable. Tortious interference, I think, is a different claim there. And we're not necessarily arguing for a global recognition of aiding and abetting across the board that applies to all causes of action. But what our contention is that aiding and abetting as to fraud is something that Texas courts have recognized before and that the courts below were proper in recognizing.
Mr. Boyd, but in the Solis case, doesn't Justice Christopher go through the different factors that an intermediate appellate court could look to when recognizing a new cause of action? Is there anything then in your briefing, anything that you've addressed in your briefing, factors that we must consider in order to recognize this as a cause of action?
Yes, in our brief, Your Honor, because we prevailed on this issue, we did not address it as directly, but we do address in our brief the Melody Home argument of the factors that you have to address in recognizing a cause of action, protecting Texas citizens, history of Texas precedent, those various factors. We distinguish Solis because it was a sexual assault case. There is not that long line of authority of joint and several liability for sexual assault. There is for common law fraud, and that's how we would make that distinction. But and I can get the court the page number when I come back up where we talk about that, but I do know we raised that Melody Home argument in our brief. Very briefly, in the time I have laying, I'm going to ruin our second issue, which is the aiding and abetting question two under the Texas Securities Act. Equity Trust's primary argument is that Sterling Trust supports its view. We think that's wrong for at least three reasons. Number one, we think Equity Trust overreads Sterling Trust. That was a charge error case in which the court looked at the evidence, but then determined that the jury was improperly instructed. Significantly, the court did not then go ahead and render judgment. It remanded that case based on the new instruction going back with that same evidence. Secondly, we proved far more in this case than what they had in Sterling Trust. In Sterling Trust, for example, the argument was that the investments did not have the proper documentation. We certainly had that allegation here, but beyond that, we had evidence of actual knowledge on the part of Equity Trust that they knew Langeth was lying to his investors about providing those documents. This case also was more than just red flags. We had a situation where Equity Trust actually adopted special procedures, their own special procedures by, in their words, upper management adopted those procedures that allowed Langeth to sidestep these requirements. That didn't exist in Sterling Trust. We also had evidence in this case that Equity Trust knew Langeth was commingling funds and making personal use of investor funds. That evidence did not exist in Sterling Trust. And lastly, we had the evidence that when the scheme fell apart in 2009, there was an email from Equity Trust to its employees to stay silent, don't say anything about the problems with Robert Langeth. That evidence didn't exist in Sterling Trust. And so to wrap that point up, Equity Trust goes through the evidence. They have the long quote on page 55 and 56 of their brief. That is, I think if you read that and compare it to the evidence in this case, you'll see that I think we far surpass what Sterling Trust said. And so for that, we would ask that the court reinstate the yes finding to question two that Judge Schulock disregarded. Unless the court has any more questions, I'll sit down with my time now.
Thank you. And Ms. Miller.
And please, the court, I too want to thank you for embarking on this new technology to have this hearing today. The trial court properly rejected Laura Hampton's claims against Equity Trust under the Texas Securities Act, and there are numerous grounds to support that. The trial court did, however, err in entering judgment against Equity Trust on the unrecognized claim of common law aiding and abetting, which in any event was barred by limitations. Before I begin the legal issues, you heard a lot of purported facts from Hampton's counsel. I want to mention a few critical facts. First, Equity Trust is a passive custodian of retirement accounts. As such, it does not provide investment advice or conduct due diligence on its clients' investments. Laura Hampton never invested with Langeth through an Equity Trust account. Equity Trust is a complete stranger to her investments with Langbook. Indeed, she invested proceeds from the sale of a house with Langbook. Finally, Laura Hampton never spoke to anyone at Equity Trust, and Equity Trust didn't even know that Laura Hampton invested with Langbook until she filed this lawsuit. Despite these undisputed facts, Hampton seeks to recover from Equity Trust for her decision. Now, the legal principles require in this case that the court doesn't even have to do a deep dive into the facts. Her claims fail on legal grounds. The take nothing judgment on the TSA claim should be upheld because it's barred by the statute of limitations, it's barred by the statute of repose, and there's insufficient evidence to support the TSA claim. Her aiding and abetting judgment should be reversed because there's no cause of action for aiding and abetting in Texas. The claims are barred by limitation, and there's insufficient evidence to support a claim for aiding and abetting. I want to mention briefly the aiding and abetting fraud because the court had questions about that. And it's been clear in the Supreme Court that there is no cause of action. There's been no recognition of the cause of action for aiding and abetting. In the Jewell case in 1997, the Supreme Court specifically said it had never adopted Section 876 of the restatement, which is the state restatement section that Laura Hampton relies on. And then as recently as 2017, in First United Pentecostal Church of Beaumont, the Supreme Court reiterated it has not decided whether Texas recognizes a cause of action for aiding and abetting. And then subsequently in Kinsel, which is a case that is cited in the Anderson case that you referred Mr. Boyd to, the Supreme Court said the question of whether a tort exists is strictly under the Supreme Court's to decide. And both in Petco and in the Anderson case, both out of this court, you said that the court is not free to mold the laws you see fit, but must follow the precedents of the Texas Supreme Court and unless until the high court overrules it. Clearly, the high court has not done it. Additionally, the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, Section 5001, says, in any action governed by the state concerning rights and obligations under the law, the restatement of law is not controlling. And if you look at the legislative history, it says the reason is because they don't necessarily reflect the state of law in Texas as it exists. And the state of law in Texas is that there's no cause of action for aiding and abetting.
Ms. Miller, assume that we would sustain Hampton's first issue. Under heat shrink, the second court has adopted heat shrink. Do we have anything in our reasoning like heat shrink saying that if we were to say that aiding and abetting is fine, that they would be held jointly and severally liable and not apportioned?
No, I don't believe there's anything in this evidence that support that. And one thing I would point out about the heat shrink case is that, find my notes about it right quick. In heat shrink, they were looking at, they don't address the issue. And if you look at heat shrink, what they did was they were saying they argued that 33 applied, but they looked at, they cited Roselle, which is a negligent entrustment case. And they ignored the Dunez case of the Supreme Court, which talks about that Chapter 33 applies in any cause of action based in tort and rejected joint several liability in the Dram Shop Act. One thing I would point out is there are some Court of Appeals decisions where they looked at avoiding Chapter 33, but they've not addressed the express language of Chapter 33, and they did not do that in the heat shrink case. There are also federal cases which say that Chapter 33 applies in an action unless the legislature creates an exception. And the legislature has not created an exception in this case. The other thing I would point out is, were there some courts of appeals who've gone off in that direction? What they've done is they've looked at it from the standpoint of vicarious liability, not from the standpoint of derivative liability. And what they said, if you have vicarious liability, you're liable for because of the relationship. And so the relationship makes you liable regardless of your percentage of fault. And that's the respondent superior situation. That's not what we have here. What we have here is a derivative claim where we're being held responsibility for our facts. And when you have that situation where it's derivative and you're looking at Langa's facts as to did he commit fraud and the facts about our acts, did we aid and abet that fraud, that's exactly the kind of proportionate fault that Chapter 33 was designed by the legislature to address when they adopted tort reform, was to hold parties responsible for their percentage of fault, not just to hold them generally responsible for other parties who may have had a different relationship. The other basis, aside from the fact that there's no cause of action for aiding and abetting, is the jury found in this case that the aiding and abetting claims were barred by limitations. And in respect to that, the overwhelming evidence is that they are barred by limitations. And in fact, there is no, Hampton has not in any way attempted to challenge the fact that the plaintiff knew or should have known by February 2nd, 2009, which would have barred her aiding and abetting claims.
Ms. Miller.
Yes.
Is there any factual dispute concerning the original sale or any extensions that might have occurred in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, that's in connection with the TSA statute. We believe that as a matter of law, the judge decided that the original sale was the date she purchased the loan participation, and that's what governs in this case. Hampton relies on a sole case that's an undecided or an unpublished decision out of the district court in New York interpreting the federal statute on a motion to dismiss. It's not even a case on the merits. And in that case, they pled that they believed that they could liquidate their investment, and the court said, well, because that doesn't go to the fraud allegation, you don't have to plead it with particularity at this point. So we're not going to grant that as a grounds for a motion to dismiss, but it is no way a finding on the merits. In fact, the Second Circuit, in which the Pollock Court sits, has made it very clear that to have a new sale under the Securities Act, and they're interpreting the federal act, that there has to be such a significant change in the nature of the investment or the investment risk to amount to a new investment. That's not the case here. We have cited a number of cases in our brief that follow Abramson and have cited that there is no new sale. For example, rollovers of CDs do not constitute a new sale to extend limitations under the Texas Securities Act. Agreements to permit loans to remain outstanding do not constitute new sales under the Federal Securities Act. Exchanging an unproductive lease for a productive lease does not constitute a new sale in that regard. The key is there has to have been.
Excuse me, Ms. Miller. So the renewal would have no. The renewal is not a sale for the purposes of this discussion here today.
That is correct, and the court found that as a matter of law.
And then what about on the question of misnomer? Does that somehow affect? On my limited review of the record. Is there any evidence as to whether or not Hampton Trust existed? Or more importantly, given that Hampton amended her petition 4 months after the original filing, is there any suggestion in the record that, just given that 4 month lag, that misnomer was misleading or on the question of harm for y'all?
First of all, I would note for the court that Hampton never pled misnomer. She never sought jury findings on misnomer, never submitted a question on misnomer. So that whole question has been raised by Hampton initially and cannot be a basis for, because the law is clear, if you're trying to avoid limitations, you have a duty to get a finding on that issue to try to avoid limitations. But to your specific address question about the facts are clear in this case as to what happened. Mr. Boyd alluded to the fact that there's a long history of this case, and I think it's important to kind of hear a little bit of that to understand what happened. This case was originally brought in March of 2012. Laura Hampton and Hampton Trust brought suit in federal court, and the federal pleading actually lists the plaintiffs as G, Laura Hampton as an individual, and B as Hampton Trust. Then Judge Yackel dismissed certain claims based on the Forum Selection Clause, including the claims of Laura Hampton individually. The claims of Hampton Trust were not dismissed. Laura Hampton went to Ohio. filed a petition saying she appears in Ohio in her individual capacity. Then you have the state court action that is filed, and Hampton Trust appears in that by and through its trustee, Laura Hampton. And then later, Laura Hampton comes back and says, Laura Grace Hampton is an individual that resides in Kerrville. She's proceeding both in her individual capacity as well as her capacity for executrix of the estate of Augusta Dubois. These were two different claims, the estate of Augusta Dubois or the trust and Laura Hampton's individual claims. And in fact, the estate settled their claims. Laura Hampton went to trial on his, so there's no question they were separate. And yes, your question was there any harm to Equity Trust? The whole time Laura Hampton continued as a plaintiff individually in this case, she maintained her case as an individual in Ohio. So Equity Trust was forced to defend individual claims of Laura Hampton both in Ohio and in Texas. When she, as a tactical matter, sought to bring herself back into Texas as an individual. And I think it's worth noting, had she not done that, had she pursued her claims in Ohio where she was an individual and brought her claims individually, she wouldn't have this problem because her claims would not have been barred by limitations. It's only when she made the tactical decision to say, wait a minute, I don't want to be in Ohio. I want to be back down in Texas where my mother's estate is and join the Texas suit that she created this limitations problem for herself. This is not a misnomer. This is a tactical decision, and it should not, the blended pleading should not relate back in that regard.
Ms. Miller, I know it's your position that they've waived making any arguments on statute of limitations with the JNOV, but they do address that in their reply brief. Could you address their argument? Specifically, she argues the trial could have not agreed with your client on limitations for purposes of the JNOV on the TSA claim because judgment for Hampton against Langeth on the TSA claim means that your limitations argument could not have supported JNOV in your favor on the TSA claim.
Well, as this court has recognized in the Solis versus Kofler case, default judgments against any other defendants do not preclude a defendant from using legal viable defenses and litigating the claims asserted against it. Just because there was a default judgment against Langeth doesn't mean that Equity Trust was precluded from raising the statute of defense. In fact, if you follow Hampton's logic, all anybody would have to do as a plaintiff is sue somebody who's going to default along with a valid defendant, and you've precluded that valid defendant from any affirmative defenses. And that's just not the law. And this course pointed that out in the Solis versus Cobra case in that regard. We believe they've waived the limitations because they did not assert it. And this court stated in Brooks versus Mass Marketing that you have to affirm a judgment if any ground stated in the motion was meritorious and the appellant failed to raise any of the grounds as an appellant ground. And in that case, two of the JNLB grounds were not addressed in the appellant's opening brief. Here, limitations was not. So based upon your prior cases here in this Court of Appeals, they've waived that issue. And as we've indicated and we've discussed from the standpoint of the sale as a matter of law, the court was correct in finding there was no new sale. These are Ponzi scheme investments. The risk didn't change, the nature didn't claim. She was never going to get recovered. It doesn't matter if she sued initially, if she claimed she renewed them. The risk never changed. The investment never changed. They were always loan participations that were part of a Ponzi scheme, and therefore she was never going to recover on them, and they just can't meet the legal standard for what it takes to constitute a new sale of a security in this case. We also believe the evidence is insufficient to support her TSA claim. When you read Sterling Trust, it's the case in Texas law, it is clear this is nothing more than a negligence case. And the Supreme Court said negligence and failure to follow procedures is not adequate to prove a Texas Securities Act claim. And with that, I'll reserve any other questions or comments until my rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Boyd.
Mr. Boyd,
you're on mute.
Sorry, Your Honor.
No, it's all good.
There we go.
Let's try again.
To take these up, and I'll try to follow Ms. Miller's order Specifically, she started with the fact that they were a passive custodian and never dealt with Laura Hampton. Sterling Trust deals with that. It makes clear that that does not impact their potential to be liable. And so Sterling Trust disposes of that argument. With respect to the Anderson versus Archer case that the court asked me about, as the court noted, that was tortious interference with inheritance, something that there was no body of case law in the lower courts recognizing. And what this court said was, we must in short follow the existing law rather than change it. And we have adhered to that basic limiting principle in a variety of contexts. And that's what we've argued all along and what we think the Judge Triana and Judge Shulock relied upon below. And that is, there is this body of existing law, albeit at the appellate level, in the Crisp case and the other cases that we cite going back to 1930, where aiding and abetting fraud is specifically recognized. This is not a case where the Supreme Court has told us this is not a cause of action. It has simply said this issue is not before us and we're not going to reach it today, strongly indicating they intend to take it up, I think, at some point when the issue arises. And we would also note that the Supreme Court does recognize aiding and abetting breach of fiduciary duty. That's long been recognized in Texas law. And so, again, we're not asking for a blanket rule that 876 applies across the board to all torts. In fact, in our pleadings, what we said was, to the extent necessary, we invoked Section 876 of the restatement. What our pleadings make clear is we've relied on the joint and several aspect of those that participate.
Mr. Brooks, Mr. Boyd, let me get more specific then. The portion of the Anderson holding that I'd like to talk about is that portion that discusses this, the Third Court of Appeals reluctance to reach out and create new tortious causes of action, new causes of action under tort law. Aren't we as a panel bound by that prior decision? Not because we've already ruled on the aiding and abetting issue, but because we have already declared a reluctance to create a new tort where the Supreme Court has not yet spoken on the issue.
And I guess that's the distinction I'm trying to make, is that that was a tortious interference with inheritance rights, something there wasn't a longstanding body of law recognizing. Whereas we're talking about those that participate in fraud being jointly liable. That goes back to at least 1930 in Texas, and we've cited those cases where that is. That's the distinction I have. I firmly recognize what the Supreme Court has said. But I believe that given the body of law that's already out there, we're not asking this court to make new law. We're simply asking this court to do what the courts below did, and that is follow the law that's out there from other sister appellate courts. And if this, you know, if the Supreme Court changes their mind on us, then that's where we are when we end up in front of them. On misnomer, I wanted to speak on that. That question came up. What Equity Trust does not talk about is the Greater Houston Orthopedics case, which is the Supreme Court case out of 2009. There, the court said when a plaintiff misnames itself, that's misnomer. And that the misnomer doctrine of relaxing standards and relating back limitations is even more relaxed when the plaintiff misnames itself for this reason. The correct defendant was sued and served. That clearly happened here. Equity Trust knew it was sued and served. As far as the pleading requirement, what this court has said in the Ekman case that we cite is that once misnomer is corrected, the issue is resolved for pleading purposes. So we corrected that, as the court noted, 4 months after we filed suit. That resolved the issue. They never sought an abatement. In fact, to speak to prejudice, if you read the Fifth Circuit opinion, which Equity Trust cites, that was the detour we took from right before trial to the Fifth Circuit, because Equity Trust sought an injunction to stop the case from going to trial below, and the Fifth Circuit reversed. What the Fifth Circuit finds is it was Equity Trust that created the prejudice by taking this case, Laura Hampton's individual case, from that first amended petition, July 1, 2013, all the way to Judge Triana's summary judgment ruling in 2016, only to have lost summary judgment and then go back to the federal court saying, well, now we want an injunction. That is all spelled out in the Fifth Circuit opinion. So I think the issue of there being any prejudice to Equity Trust from the four-month delay in Laura Hampton correctly naming herself is certainly non-existent and certainly does not warrant undoing Judge Shulock's ruling below on that point.
Mr. Boyd, let me shift you to this sale issue. What is a sale or a resale? You rely on Pollack in your briefs, but even Pollack cites the Abrahamson's test that Ms. Miller cited. So aren't you overreading Pollack? I mean, how do these rollover investments fall within the Abramson test?
Because it goes directly to whether there was a renewed commitment to the sale. That's the key word that's used in Pollock and in Abramson and in all the New York cases that Equity Trust now cites. That's the general federal rule. If I'm just rolling over an investment and it's just an automatic renewal of a CD or something like that, that's one thing. But when I have the honest choice to say I want to go forward or I want to stop my investment now, and you make the decision to go forward, which is exactly what was the issue in Pollock, because that involves the exact same type of investments we have here. Not CDs, not partnership interests, not the other types in those cases. Pollock involves the exact same bridge loan type investment. And when the investor makes a commitment to renew the sale, that speaks directly to the new sale requirement that Pollock talks about when it cites Abramson. And if you reread Pollock, it does talk about Abramson in those cases, and it centralizes on that one issue is, have the investor made a new commitment, a renewed commitment to the sale? And that is exactly what Jack Hampton's testimony references. Several points he was asked, what happened at maturity? I called Langeth. I had the option to take our money back out, Laura Hampton's money out. We didn't. We stayed with it. That evidence was unrebutted.
Mr. Boyd, what was then, though, but the Pollock also cites this significant change in the nature of the investment. So what was the significant change for Ms. Hampton in the nature of her investment when she renewed her investment?
I believe it's the same that Pollock speaks to. It's the significant change of the changing conditions of the real estate market. I mean, we do know that did change as you grew closer and closer to 2009. I think there was also discussion in the testimony that Mr. Hampton talked about with Langeth that new properties were brought in. He would shuffle one property in for another one, and so they would be investing in a new property with a new borrower. That creates a new significant change of risk. And so for all those reasons, Jack Hampton's testimony addressed those issues. And the important point, I think, is there was nothing offered to rebut that. The only people that testified on this were Jack Hampton about his dealings with Robert Langeth. Nancy Vaughn, another victim, also testified about it. And even Langeth himself admitted in his plea papers, although he took the fifth at trial, in his plea papers in the criminal, he admitted he would roll over properties and change them into new properties as maturity came. That speaks, I think, directly to the risk change that Pollock and Abramson talk about, because if I'm going from one property to another, that's a different risk that I have to evaluate and make a commitment to at that time of sale.
Mr. Boyd, can I have you address the statute of limitations and the argument that it's been waived? I guess, you know, looking at the briefs here, that the first time I see that you address the statute of limitations is in your reply brief. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please do.
Okay. I think it has to do with the unique nature of the Texas Securities Act. This is not a situation where you have one defendant that could waive the limitations and one that would not. To prove our case against Equity Trust, we had to prove a primary violation by Robert Langeth. And I think the record will support this. We never defaulted Langeth. His claims were live at trial. We had to move for directed verdict on his untruth or omission violation, which Judge Shulock granted. But Equity Trust put in issue question of limitations and other questions that pertain to the Securities Act. The limitations language of the Security Act speaks directly to discovery rule. It's a discovery rule statute. In other words, you have to file suit within 3 years of when you discover the untruth or omission. As discovery rule is a burden that's placed on the plaintiff. So we had to prove that at trial. Where I think the issue came was we raised that post-verdict, and Judge Shulock issued a ruling post-verdict. And in his ruling, the first thing he ruled was he is going to enter judgment against Langeth on the Texas Securities Act. We interpreted that, and we asked for follow-up for clarification, but we interpret that as he rejected the contention that limitations barred the claim because it was at issue before him.
Did Langeth ever assert a limitations defense?
No, Your Honor, but that's the point I'm trying to get to. I think it was our burden from the word go, because the language of the statute, which is unique to the common law discovery rule, which is different. And the Devon Energy case out of Houston speaks to the differences between the statutory remedy and the common law discovery rule. What the statute says is no person may sue unless filed within 3 years of discovery. So we had that burden from the get-go. Limitations is essentially raised by the statute, and we have the burden to prove that. And where I come with that is there was also the issue of interest, if I may finish just answering this question. There was the issue of interest under the Securities Act, which Equity Trust also challenged. Langeth never challenged interest, just like he never made any kind of pleading. But in Judge Shulock's ruling, he, even though he only entered judgment against Langeth on the Securities Act and not equity trust, he adopted equity trust argument that the interest rate was only the statutory rate and not the contract rate. If this was a simple default, we would have walked over and recovered the maximum interest we wanted against Langeth as well. But Judge Shulock didn't rule that way. And that's why we did not address it in the opening brief. We do address it in the reply brief, I think, as Justice Kelly pointed out, on that ground and on the grounds that the evidence simply is specific to the date that the jury found.
And we have to use the date of renewal to get us past the limitations.
No question about it. If the original sale date was the only date that counted, this would have been a summary judgment from the word go when Judge Triana first addressed this issue, because nobody disputed the original sale date was more than 5 years before. That's why we have argued all along that Judge Triana clearly adopted the Pollack rule. Otherwise, we wouldn't have got past summary judgment to begin with.
Thank you, Mr. Boyd. Well, okay, Ms. Miller, yes.
First of all, I would point out that whatever Judge Triana ruled in summary judgment has no bearing once you've been to trial on the merits. Essentially, there was no order, there was no letter, there was just a letter saying, I deny it. That's all there ever was. So to rely on that, there's no basis for that. I want to talk about the statute of repose. He talks about Langeth never at trial answered. It was a default judgment against Langeth. It was taken at trial, but it was a default. He never appeared. He never answered. He never asserted any defenses. You can't use that against equity trust to say that they can't raise limitations in that regard. And in any event, their claims are barred by the statute of repose. Pollack, remember, is a case on a motion to dismiss. There's no finding on the merits that they determined that that was a new sale. All the court said was you've pleaded it well enough. You don't have to plead it with particularity. You get past the hurdle for a motion to dismiss. You have to look at Abrahamson and the other cases, which clearly say there has to be evidence of a new investment or a new risk factor in order to get a new sale, to get past the original sale date. And they just don't have that in this case. There was no evidence about written extensions or emails. There's vague testimony from Jack Hampton that, yeah, they kind of rolled them over when they did. Their own accounting records show the sale date, and then they show the maturity date based on the original sale. There's no evidence of extension in their own documents. Furthermore, I think it's telling, Hampton pleaded that Langeth misrepresented the investments were rolled over at maturity when they were not. Now they want to say, contrary to their original pleadings, that, oh, never mind, they were extended and rolled over. And that just is not the case. There's simply
Ms. Miller?
Yes.
Ms. Miller, I want to talk about what you needed to do to establish your defense on the statute of repose. There's no dispute that you pleaded it. There's no dispute that you requested a jury question on it, and that question was refused. But now, doesn't that procedural background suggest that repose can't support the JNOV? And if so, shouldn't there be, I know you've asked for a reverse and remand, but if so, shouldn't there be then a new trial where there's a properly submitted repose question to the jury?
Well, first of all, you would go back to the point that you have to assume all of the grounds were it was granted on repose as well as all the other grounds when you have a JNOV. On the repose,
as I understand that, the JNOV asserted limitations and repose, correct?
Correct. We asserted both as well.
So if the trial court was correct on either of those two bases.
Correct. Limitations, repose, and insufficiency of evidence. We submitted all three. So if he's correct on any of those, then the trial court judgment should be affirmed. On the question of repose, we submitted a question on repose out of an abundance of caution. Hampton argued that it was a matter of law for the court, and the court rejected our question and decided the decision as a matter of law. So if you conclude that as a matter of law, the trial court was correct on his repose issue, then there's no need to send the case back for another trial, because he decided it as a matter of law. For Hampton now to claim that for some reason it was a question of fact that we somehow waived or did something, they can't do that because that would be to invite error, which is improper. So because the court overruled it, decided it as a matter of law, you review his decision on repose as a matter of law in that regard. And we believe that when you look at the evidence, it's clear that the standards of a new investment, we cited cases where there's new property, which Mr. Boyd referred to. You know, we cited cases where there are the other kinds of changes. And remember, there's no evidence of any of that kind of thing in the record that you have. It's simply Jack Hampton saying, oh, when these came up, I talked to him and we agreed not to extend him. And they basically said, we agreed to just let him keep going and not pay us, which is exactly, we have a case exactly on that point, that continuing to allow a debt unpaid is not a new sale under the Securities Act. I want to turn to Sterling just a second as to exactly what it says it's not enough. Because Sterling's very clear in terms of what it says you have to show. A meal of failure to investigate is not enough under Sterling. You have to be aware of the improper activities before it can be held liable for assisting. And negligence, ignoring internal procedures, the Supreme Court said, that might have alerted the IRA custodian to the fraudster, maybe negligence, but it's not reckless disregard of the law. If you take a look at the Sterling case, and the court's case in Sterling, and you go down the page where the court walks through the evidence in Sterling, and then you look at the evidence that the plaintiffs presented in this case, it is virtually identical. And the court said that's not enough to get you there. And even plaintiffs' own experts, they talked to you about evidence, but I think most telling is what plaintiffs' experts said. Their own experts said there was no evidence that we knew that Equity Trust knew of Langa's fraud. The special counsel to the bankruptcy trustee and Laura Hampton's lawyer affirmatively found after an extensive investigation that no one aided and abetted Langa's in his fraud. Their expert on the issue of aiding and abetting securities fraud at the TSA, the basis for his opinion that Equity Trust aided and abetted Langa was that Equity Trust failed to follow its own policies and procedures. That's the evidence. That's what the Supreme Court in Sterling Trust said is insufficient to show that you're aiding and abetting a statute. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. Thank you, Mr. Boyd. Unless there's anything further from the panel?
No.
Then this case will be submitted. It'll be available on the court's website as soon as we can get that up there. And we appreciate your patience and your submission of argument. This was a great first experience for me. Thank you. And this proceeding is adjourned.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Honors.
Thank you.